From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a Milwaukee university extends a helping hand to students with autism spectrum disorders to help them navigate the college experience.
Later, the 16th Street Community Health Center focuses specifically on bike use and more frequent exercise among the people it serves.
The obesity rates for the Latino community are really high, along with the African American community, and the same thing with diabetes and other chronic illnesses.
And the MSO's principal violist, Robert Levine, reveals why he chose the viola all those years ago.
This is a way to meet people and play chamber music, and I'll always be in demand, and I always was, and, you know, meet girls. And I mean, you know, it was a geeky viola thing, but you actually could back then. And it was great.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. As the current academic year wraps up at colleges and universities across the country, one area school is already preparing to welcome students this fall. A new program at Marquette University aims to make college life a success for a particular group of incoming students.
Students with autism spectrum disorders can have particular challenges in a college environment away from the safety net of relatives and friends. A Marquette professor and researcher who specializes in autism spectrum disorders is behind the innovative program called On Your Mark, which will serve 8 to 10 students in its first year.
Amy Van Hecke is an associate professor of psychology at Marquette. She and clinical assistant professor of educational policy and leadership Mary Carlson joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio recently. Van Hecke talked about some of the distinct challenges that students with autism spectrum disorders face at college.
So I think the biggest piece that someone who's on the autism spectrum in college that they would struggle with is accessing the supports they need. Mm-hmm. So we know in autism that communication is something that is really challenging for them. So even if a school has tutoring or has supports in place, actually calling and getting that connection set up is really, really challenging for someone on the spectrum. Also, there's sort of this transition to independence that happens, and I think this happens with all college students, that they struggle with, you know, living on their own in the dorms, taking care of themselves, getting themselves to class. And many of our students on the spectrum also kind of struggle with that aspect of organization and planning and really kind of making that leap from having a parent that helps them to being on their own.
And not only from having a parent that helps them, but also if they had a diagnosis in high school, they had what's called an individual educational plan, and they had a team of probably a psychologist and a speech and language therapist and a special ed teacher who together shepherded them through high school. And that's no longer there when they get to college.
Is that pretty standard that support system just stops after high school graduation?
It does.
By law.
Yeah.
Yeah. The special education law only covers you until you graduate from high school.
Historically, what do you know about how students with autism spectrum disorders have fared at Marquette or even universities in general?
Pretty poorly. Many students that do sort of enter college, students on the spectrum that enter college, either they take much, much longer to graduate or they don't graduate at all. They also experience a lot of mental health concerns while in college, stress, depression, anxiety. So even in this best case scenario that they're applying to college and they get into college, there are a lot of barriers for them to successfully finish in college.
I think in particular about a mom that we met through the PEERS program that we run. It's a social skills program for teens and young adults, and their parents and the teens and young adults are on the autism spectrum. And the first night, there was a mom who wept silently for the whole 2 hours. And she was weeping silently because her very bright son had just been kicked out of college. It wasn't Marquette. It was another local university. It wasn't because he wasn't smart enough. It was because he did not know how to talk to the professor when he was in trouble or how to find the kind of help that he needed.
Mm-hmm. And we had another student, I would say, that many years ago that the parents contacted me from California. And, you know, they said, you know, we found you by searching autism on the Marquette website. And our son is a student. And, and he needs some help. And, you know, and there are all these FERPA laws where I can't even say that I know their student goes to Marquette. I don't have a relationship with this student. And I wanted to help, and I did find a way to help, but it was really challenging not having a structure set up to do that. And in this particular challenge, the student had no family here, and he had come from California and no family, and he had stopped eating. So the dining hall was just too intense, too noisy, too chaotic for him, and with sensory sensitivities. And so he'd stopped eating and hadn't eaten for 3 days. So I managed to find an undergrad willing to go take him a bag of food. You know, we got him to eat again, and eventually we got him into a different dorm. You know, there are better, smaller places to be, but that wasn't part of something that he would have had help with, is picking a dorm that would really suit him. And, you know, we got him through it, and I think he's in law school now. He graduated, but, you know, we don't want to be dealing with emergencies, right? We really want to set students up for success and not be waiting until things go wrong.
Well, and I would imagine that having resources like these in place could spell the difference not just between success and failure at college, but being able and willing to make that next step into wanting to go to college once you're done with high school.
Yes. So I would say many of our families wouldn't consider a college unless it had a support program. So, you know, they come to us for things like social skills, for peers, for 14 weeks, and they buy the Marquette sweatshirt. And then when they hear we didn't have a support program, it was this huge disappointment. And they would look elsewhere because there are other schools around the country that have these programs. There's nothing in Wisconsin, really. So, you know, we have kind of a wide area that we can draw from and that we can serve. And, you know, why are we losing these families that have already developed this relationship with us?
Right. So why don't you walk us through how this program was developed?
We have a team.
Yes, we have a team, and we have had a goal for many years now.
Yes.
Like, I would say this goes back, gosh, like 6 years probably. I wrote a grant to NIH, the National Institutes of Health, maybe 6 years ago, and it was not funded. I don't even think they read it. and, you know, that's just not something they do, is fund support programs at colleges. This really needed a different way to get started, and you need money to start up something big like this, you know. So we had been trying various pathways and encountering just a lot of barriers and not a lot of buy-in, and, you know, and then this team and I, you know, Mary and Wendy and I really...
Wendy Krieger is the speech and language therapist that we work very closely with.
We started teaching a class on autism together, an undergraduate class, and got a grant from Marquette to do that. And then we started really, you know, kind of plotting, like, okay, how can we make things happen? There's three of us now, you know, there's momentum. I know, the cauldron.
Yeah.
And, you know, what can we cook up?
Yeah.
And so we really just started thinking more and more about it, trying different avenues, trying different grants, like internal grants. It's still not happening. And then I would say that the turning point was that Mary got a Jesuit in on board with us.
You know, when you're in trouble, you can call a Jesuit.
Yeah.
And I don't know how this Jesuit and I struck up this friendship, but came to me very humbly, and he said, you know, I have a lot of families who are struggling with kids with autism, and I'm not sure how to minister to them appropriately, and I'd really like to walk with them. And so he became our unofficial chaplain.
Part of our crew.
Yeah. And he stopped by my office one day and he said, did you see this article in the New York Times about a college support program? Isn't this what you and Amy and Wendy have been talking about? And I said, yes. So it was really exciting. And I was going to share it with Amy, and at the same time...
That same day, we get a call from Advancement that there is a donor, an alumnus, that has seen this same article in the New York Times that wants to fund a program at Marquette. I mean, it was really like kismet, you know? I mean, and apparently Advancement had gone searching around, like, there's this donor that wants to do this. Who does this? Anyone interested in this? This was not something they were pushing. This was something that the alumnus, John Miller and Kate Miller, came to Advancement with and said, you know, look, this is something we want to do. Do you have the people to do it? Was that just that puzzle fit, you know, that matching, that clicking of like we have a plan and a method and a will, and then there's a donor that really has the philanthropy and the viewpoint of really how this can change society. So
and John and Kate Miller really have that vision.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of input have you gotten from students or even former students with autism spectrum disorders or parents? You know, you mentioned that some parents have had to look at other places after learning that Marquette didn't have the support system. So how did this input or anything you've discovered while researching before this grant came into place, how did that shape the program?
When we think about when we talk to families and stakeholders, right, we call families people with autism that can advocate for themselves, stakeholders about, you know, what's wanted. Supports in adulthood are really a hot topic right now. So, you know, Wisconsin has a really long, lovely history of supporting children with interventions and things like that. But then you graduate and you drop off the map. And you're still around and you still have autism and you still need supports. And you particularly need those supports to make those jumps, those big jumps into educational opportunities and then into the workforce. And, you know, I think the research community is acknowledging this, that this is something that we really need to figure out, like what works best, what's helpful. And then the parents and the individuals on the spectrum themselves are saying, like, help us figure this out. Like, don't just worry about genetics, you know, but really help us live our best lives. Part of what we're doing in this planning year that we have is to really engage nationally with, I guess I have a graduate student that's doing a survey of individuals both preparing for college, who have are at college now, who went through a college experience with or without a program, and then parents as well about what they think are the essential elements. You know, and then another piece of it, I think, is reviewing, like, what are the programs out there that have lived the longest and that are the most successful? What elements do they have there, and kind of try to do that here?
One of the really beautiful things about finding one another and about silo busting is that we all have the same heart, but we have different brains. But somehow there's a magic that happens when you bust out of your silo. And we've learned to speak one another's languages. And one of the things, pieces that I have is, besides being a special ed teacher, I've been studying theology. And I keep going back to St. Thomas Aquinas saying that every human should be able to develop to their fullest human flourishing. That's what we want. A program like this may be the difference between somebody leading a happy and fulfilling life in which their special brain gifts are added to society and ending up sitting in their parents' basement.
And the statistics are really, really depressing. You know, without these kinds of support programs and help, you know, many, I would say 80% of our young adults on the spectrum are unemployed. 85% are still living at home well into their adult life. We're losing people that really have something to give. Their brains are wired in a really unique way to solve problems uniquely. And this is what we need. You know, I mean, in this day and age, we need people who can come at problems from different perspectives and with different skills and talents. And to lose that is just, it's stupidity on our part to not keep those people in the game. You know, with the increasing kind of rates of autism and with kids getting services earlier and earlier, we have more and more individuals on the spectrum who really do need to be going to college and who can fulfill that, can carry out that work. It's at least half, if not a little bit more than half, of the individuals on the spectrum who do not have an intellectual disability. And it's particularly those ones without an intellectual disability that have the poorest outcomes, which is kind of counter to what the rest of the disability world thinks. So when you generally when you have a disability, the more severe your intellectual impairment, the sort of more challenged your outcomes are. But in autism, it's actually a little different. It's that when you have no intellectual disability, it's a really strong predictor for very poor outcome. And so, you know, these are the kids we would see coming through the doors of Marquette or that could come through the doors of Marquette. So we have to figure out how do we get them through the doors, doing well through the doors, out the doors, and into something that really will utilize their gifts.
Yeah. How are you able to identify potential students to come to Marquette with this program?
Yes. They will have to self-identify. Mm-hmm. Our admissions people will be handing out information, but mm-hmm. they will have to come to us.
Or have a someone, who an advocate who can help them come to us in
right.
the beginning. And, you know, I think that that identification is what enables us to do our best support, right? It's when someone has not been identified and is kind of struggling but not really part of a system of supports, we really can't do a lot. But that identifying from the start, we can start off on the right foot.
We think of it as scaffolding, mm-hmm. you know, and you take the bits of scaffold away when they're no longer needed. I used to be a special ed teacher, so I am interested in helping them structure their academics for success. And we are working with the Office of Disability Services. And after it's all planned and put in place, we're going to step back.
Yeah. We're going to hire someone to direct the program.
Yep, there will be a program director.
It's a full-time job, you know, and then we're hiring coaches and to really be the point person for each student. So that's someone that they'll check in with that will help be their voice until they can have their own voice.
A lot of these issues that you're touching upon are things that many new college students struggle mm-hmm. with, you know, whether they are on the spectrum or not.
Absolutely.
And it's just multiplied tenfold for people on the spectrum.
Right.
Do you think there are lessons that the greater campus support community might take from this work?
I'm always thinking, like, let's do something that can serve multiple purposes, too, right? So we're helping these students achieve their full potential. We're realizing the generous and really, you know, wonderful ideas of a donor. We're realizing a dream we've had for many years. But let's also educate the rest of the students. You know, I think a lot of times when we work with people with disabilities, we're so focused on helping them and educating them and making sure they get what they need. Sometimes there's broader education that needs to happen in the community of how do you interact with someone on the spectrum? How do you support them? How do you be an ally for them? How do you not assume why people's behavior is for a certain reason when it maybe is more innocuous? So what we hope to do is that by having these students here, we enrich the entire community. You know, we have a real capacity issue with people who understand autism, professionals that understand autism and know how to work with people with autism. So we want to build that while we're helping the students. So we're kind of doing something today and we're doing something for the future.
And it's a very strong issue of social justice. We live in a very ableist society. We see from a very able-bodied, neurotypical viewpoint, and that's really not the world. An additional social justice piece is that kids of color and poor kids tend not to have access to the proper services to get diagnosed so that they could get help in school and then come on to college. So we really have to educate the public. I'm thinking about Doris Walker Dollhouse is a literacy specialist, and she and Wendy and Amy and I ran a little camp last summer for younger children on the spectrum. And we brought in some neurotypical kids without autism to be with the kids who had autism. And my granddaughter was one of them. And Wendy had been in the room with her one day, and I wasn't in her room. And I said, "Well, Lily, what did you do at camp today?" And she said, "You know, we were coloring and we were jumping over a bridge and we were working on eye contact with Lizzie." And she looked at me and she said, "You know, Nana, we all got stuff to work on." And that's the seed right there, right? Planting it when they're young so that they see that as part of a normal human experience.
Amy Van Hecke is an associate professor of psychology, and Mary Carlson is a clinical assistant professor of educational policy and leadership at Marquette University. They spoke with WUWM's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can learn more about the On Your Mark program for students with autism spectrum disorders at WUWM.com. Bonnie North, this is not the first segment we've heard on Lake Effect that deals with issues like autism spectrum disorders and other, you know, other challenges that college students or anybody might face. It's just part of the tapestry that is Lake Effect each and every day.
That's right. And when you support us with your contribution, that's the kind of programming that you are supporting. When you call 414-227-3210, you go to WUWM.com not only to check out this story, but to also make a contribution. You can also, while you're there, if you can make a $120 donation or a $10 a month or more donation, you can also choose to get a T-shirt that basically says, I'm well informed. It's got these wonderful gold headphones on it and, of course, Milwaukee's NPR logo on it as well. And we would love for you to have one of those to show your pride in the programming that you support. We're trying to get 12 donors in this hour.
You can do it by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting wuwm.com/give. And thank you so much.
After a break, the 16th Street Community Health Center's efforts to focus on exercise and bike use among residents of the South Side. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In cities such as Milwaukee, there are barriers to healthy living for many residents in neighborhoods with challenging economic conditions, such as the Near South Side. Organizations such as the 16th Street Community Health Center exist to help area residents navigate those barriers. Tatiana Maida is the 16th Street Healthy Choices Department manager. She says one key obstacle is a lack of safe outside space where people can freely exercise and engage with their community.
This Saturday, 16th Street will focus on bicycles and bike use in a special event at Kosciuszko Park. Bike Day includes a bike giveaway, but Maida says the event will promote the larger health benefits for families and people of all ages to create more positive purposes than just pedaling.
She joined Lake Effect Audrey Nowakowski in the studio ahead of Bike Day and started by offering some more perspective on the obstacles faced by patients who use 16th Street Community Health Centers.
Right now, about 85% of our residents are Latino, not just immigrants, but Latino from Latino region. However, our agency serves the whole population, so it can be from any ethnic group. Our different locations, we are right now expanding to different places, so probably we're going to receive a little bit some change in the numbers that we have, because initially we were centered in the near south side of Milwaukee, which is a predominantly Latino area. And that particular area, the main challenges that we see is how to live healthy lifestyles, because that's an environment, the neighborhoods in communities of color, usually in the whole country, those communities don't have the access to healthy foods or, say, physical activity. So that's the number one challenge. And then because of that, those families, those residents, that in this case, most of them are immigrants, they cannot live the healthy life that they would like. The obesity rates for the Latino community are really high, along with the African American community, and the same thing with diabetes and other chronic illnesses.
In order to have a healthy lifestyle, how can more opportunities be created for the education of these residents and for them to be able to feel safe to go outside and exercise, or to have a store nearby that gives fresh produce and isn't in a food desert and only convenience stores?
Right. Well, regarding food, I have to say that in this particular neighborhood, we are very blessed to have grocery stores that provide all the fruits and vegetables that we might want. Actually, we have Pizza and El Rey that are medium-sized grocery stores, and they provide a lot. So the south side of Milwaukee really is not a food desert, and I don't like that term anymore, but the challenges really are the excess of fast food places. So you might have a grocery store that has fruits and vegetables. However, you become addicted to fast food. In high-income neighborhoods, you might see a McDonald's every 3 miles. In these places, in the same block, you might have three different fast food places. So when you don't have time to cook and you want to eat outside, and all what you have outside are just places full of fat and sugar, then you become addicted to that. So that's one challenge in terms of food. Now, in terms of physical activity, the streets are not safe. We have recently completed a bikeability assessment and a walkability assessment. We have been walking through about 500 streets in the Near South Side to really understand the conditions of the streets and the feelings when you are walking or biking on those streets. And definitely, the conditions are not good. more than 50% of the streets don't have bike lanes. Actually, more than that in terms of bike lanes, but crosswalks is at least half of the main streets. And the cars are just speeding. So the feeling of safety is not present. And if you combine that with the mental health situation with the Latino community, that there's a lot of depression, anxiety, and the therapist might tell the person, go and walk. But however, you walk and you feel even more stressed, you're more afraid. So streets are not really the best place. And that's why we are trying to create grassroots movement to improve the conditions of the streets, the safety in terms of education of people, and also partner with the city, with the police department, and different organizations to work around safer streets.
You mentioned that real community-driven change to make safer streets. With your recent look at how safe the streets are, how walkable, how bikeable, what do you find has been the most effective in moving towards making these streets safer?
We are working on that right now, and I think there's a good momentum because the city and this coalition of organizations that right now are working towards complete streets policy. That's a policy that hopefully is going to pass by the Common Council this year. We are with the Bike Federation and American Heart Association, different organizations. We are together trying to have this support the city so this policy passes. That's going to help because that policy means that instead of just looking at the driver's needs in the streets, are going to look at the pedestrians, bikers, people with disabilities. So that's one big step, but that's not going to be everything. We need to really work with the city to make sure that the streets are safe to walk. There are speed limits, stop signs where they need to be, crosswalks, all that. That's a big thing. But along with that, we need to really educate our community. We cannot be crossing in the middle of the street. And drivers and walkers, they need to be very aware of each other. So hopefully we are going to do this grassroots kind of task force with community leaders across the Near South Side. That's where we are working right now. And what I see is that the changes are not going to be from day to night, but I think if we have a strong educational campaign along with those engineering changes, the streets can become a better place for everyone.
I imagine it would be a challenge to try and implement that change. And of course, it's very important for children who might want to be playing outside on the sidewalks, riding their bike. How do you plan to make people who, say, perhaps don't have a family or are just worrying about themselves to see how their actions have a greater impact?
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying that we need to work with residents and community leaders, because the peer-to-peer education, the peer-to-peer conversation, the dialogue in community groups, that's where I see more hope. Neighbors talk with among neighbors. But we need to reach out to those conversations and bring education. I think that there's so much power. We've been working for the last 9 years with this community group called Latinos for Health, Latinos por la Salud. And along with them, we've been working with grocery stores. They are giving education in the schools, in parks, in different places. And I see how people listen to them because they are part of the community. So I think the education, the peer-to-peer education and the grassroots can have so much more success when we just take decisions top to bottom.
Right. One example of going from the grassroots up is the upcoming 16th Street Bike Day, Community Health in Motion. One of the main things that are happening on Saturday is such things as bike giveaway, giving residents bikes who either could not afford or could not have access to one. What do you hope that giving bikes as a way for transportation, for health, for getting outside, what that will spring forward to try and accomplish?
Sure. Southside Bicycle Day, this is the seventh year that we're organizing this event, and probably is one of the largest event in the neighborhood. I remember a couple years ago, we had up to 800 people in the park for 3 hours. So it was big. And this event, part of it is the giveaway of bikes. We have over 300 bikes to give. We have helmets for every kid that is going to come to the park. We have locks. However, the main thing is really, one, create awareness. So to say, okay, we want safer streets, and that's a combination between people being more present on the streets, so the cars kind of slow down, and at the same time, cars need to slow down because people is on the street. So it kind of goes both ways. So we want to give lots of education and resources to families in the South Side to say, okay, this is what you can have and what you can do. We know that about 50% of the people don't have bikes. We're not expecting that people is going to be going to work in a bike, but if we can start doing recreation through using bikes, but at the same time, again, we need to work with the safety of the streets. And let me add something else about this event. It's going to be a very nice day for the whole family because the families, sometimes they don't have a place where they can feel connected with their community. And we've seen that this event brings the families together and the community together. One of the nice things we're going to have is that people is going to be able to learn how to bike, either adults or kids. And that's another challenge that we have in this community, that we might not know how to use a bike. So there's going to be a lot of activities. We want to create community, but also bring a lot of resources. It's just not, we're going to have bikes to give away, but it's not just that.
Well, and there's also nutritional information on top of this. So biking can be a good form of exercise. It's also good recreation. But adding the nutritional aspect on top of that to help create a more healthy lifestyle for families and people of all ages. So what kind of nutritional things are going to be happening, especially with your managerial status with the obesity department?
Yeah, definitely. It's a big package of things to be healthy. It's the three pillars that we say, the nutrition aspect, the physical activity, and also the stress management and the connection, the human connection. And I think this event brings a little bit of everything. We're going to have different tables with nutrition education. We're going to also offer resources to people because we have a bicycle club in the neighborhood, a walking club. So we have different activities just from 16th Street, but we have tons of other organizations that are coming also to share the resources that they have. So again, it's nutrition. We're going to give food. Pete's and El Rey have been great, always donating fruits and vegetables. Pete's, but it's going to be there. So people will eat. We'll eat healthy. We'll have an opportunity to have bike rides, learn how to use a bike, dance, and connect the emotional part. It's extremely important for this community in particular.
Especially with Milwaukee changing so much from neighborhood to neighborhood, we see, say, bike lanes in other areas of the city, or you have the Oak Leaf Trail, but not everyone has access to it. So with the businesses collaborating, as you mentioned, donating their goods and services for this day, do you see that this will be the standard to try and implement change of organizing the businesses on a local level versus the top down, and hoping that the city sees, or the higher governmental powers see, that this change on the bottom is more effective than trying to wait for, say, a policy to be approved?
Yes, we need to have this collective impact approach. And that's happening in different ways and in different topics, because businesses need to be part. They are becoming more part. I just to give you an example, many years ago, we did a healthy grocery store campaign and with Pizza and El Rey, and we introduced about 8 new items that they didn't have in those stores that were healthy, and otherwise you will have to go to Outpost to get those items. And after that, I remember that Pete's and El Rey, they both started to include healthy recipes in their deli, and then later Pete's opened a community farm a block away. So definitely the stores are becoming more engaged, and we need to keep doing that engagement with businesses, but with everyone. Again, what I see usually is that there's a nice, well, not easy, but usually happens collaboration between community organizations and the city, perhaps the police. But residents' voice usually is out of the table, and sometimes we just assume that what people might want and think. So our role is really to see, we need to bring people to the table, and they need to speak by themselves about what they need, what their fears are, what the solutions are, because they might identify issues that we don't see from the place where we are at.
Tatiana Maida is the 16th Street Healthy Choices Department Manager. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. 16th Street hosts Bike Day Community Health in Motion on Saturday at Kosciuszko Park. There is more information about the event at WUWM.com. And there is also information there about how you can become a member or renew your membership during our 2018 Spring Membership Drive. Mitch Teich is in the studio with me, and we are hoping to get your call at 414-227-3210.
We are on our way to achieving our goal of 12 new or renewing members during this hour of Lake Effect. Again, you can play a role by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting WUWM.com/give. You can renew your membership. You can become a new member. You can take advantage of an opportunity to get our brand new I'm Well Informed t-shirt. It's got the WUWM logo, waveform, if you look really closely, and some pretty cool looking headphones. That's available when you make a one-time contribution of $120 or more, or a sustaining membership at the $10 or more per month level. You can check out a picture of that t-shirt at WUWM.com.
And we thank everyone who's already made a contribution. We are just waiting to hear from you. 414-227-3210, WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then the MSO's principal violist, Robert Levine, stops by to talk about his upcoming performances with the orchestra this weekend. Lake Effect continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The viola, like the accordion and the banjo, is often the butt of musical jokes. Not as dramatic as its string cousins, the violin or the cello, the viola nevertheless has a beautiful sound and is a crucial part of orchestras and chamber music ensembles.
Robert Levine is the principal violist for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. It's a position he's held since 1987. And in those 31 years, he's more than put to rest the idea that the viola is somehow a lesser instrument. This weekend, he'll perform Ray Vaughan Williams' beautiful piece, Flos Campi, and he stopped by the studio to chat with us about the piece and the instrument. Robert Levine, it is great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, you're here to talk about this wonderful Ray Vaughan Williams piece that you're going to be performing with the symphony. But before we get to it, I want to talk about the viola itself. You are the first chair at the symphony, and you know, you've played in lots of other orchestras as well. What was it about the viola that drew you? Most people go for the violin. The viola is like the poor stepchild.
It's true. In many ways. It was actually a very functional choice. I started on violin, as do probably most violists. Certainly most violists did, less so now. And I developed an interest in later in high school in chamber music. But the problem with chamber music is you need a viola. And I couldn't find one. So I decided, what the heck, you know, I'll try it. And it actually worked very well for me physically because I'm, you know, tall and long arms. I liked the sound a lot. So after high school, I essentially transitioned to become a violist. And it was not with the thought of becoming a professional, because that was not something I ever intended. It was more, this is a way to meet people and play chamber music, and I'll always be in demand, and I always was, and, you know, meet girls. And I mean, you know, it was a geeky viola thing, but you actually could back then. And it was great, and I loved playing the instrument, and I loved the inner part, and, you know, I loved being popular, so I stuck with it.
The thing about the viola, besides, you know, the girls and the fame, is fame. The tone of it, the timbre of it is so rich and so warm, and I don't know if it's between that and the cello that most closely mimics the human voice, but there's something about those two inner voices.
It's a very alto voice, for sure. The cello functionally has more range. I mean, the cello can go, you know, up and do soprano, and obviously does bass, and you know, it's the bass voice in a quartet or orchestra. The viola is very much a middle voice. Not that it can't go up, but it really lives in that middle alto range. And in fact, you know, in some languages, the what you see on the viola parts and scores is alto. French, for example. You know, it just
and
is.
And you're also an alto clef, too, aren't you?
That's correct.
Yeah. So you got to learn another clef in addition
to
learning another instrument.
Oh, that took a while. yeah, it's funny. The clef, it's not it feels very unnatural and did for the longest time. I don't know why that is. It's just
– Well, most people, if they know music at all, they'll
you know
the
treble and bass.
Treble and
bass.
Right.
And that's what I learned. And, you know, alto clef, that was kind of a weird one. And there are little tricks for transitioning violinists that, you know, think of it in this position but play it in this position. And that works a lot of the time until you get accidentals and then you get all confused. But I figured it out eventually. So.
Well, that's good. The other thing that violists, at least historically, have put up with was a lot less music to do, a lot less solo music. I mean, violins and cellos got all of the glory.
It has never been a solo instrument. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is the range. One is I think that it always was kind of a poor stepchild of the violin. And you can tell even in Baroque music where the way they wrote it with the assumption that the violists really weren't going to be very good. So even in
– Or they didn't want to be there. They
were kind of the servants that couldn't quite master the violin, so they stuck them on viola. Even in Corelli, you know, from the Baroque, you can see where anytime the violas have a line and the cellists are free, the cellists are doubling the viola line because the composer didn't trust the violas to handle it by themselves. So there really were no solo violists at all until Paganini. And Paganini was, you know, solo violas kind of as a sideline to being a – you know, this unbelievable violin virtuoso. So although Mozart concertized on violin, he also wrote, you know, I mean, he wrote really the first big piece for viola solo, and it wasn't viola solo, it was violin and viola. But he played viola. He liked playing viola. In fact, that was his preferred instrument in chamber music. And he wrote some wonderful chamber music for viola. And the viola parts, the great viola parts are really in chamber music, I think. Mozart, some of the Beethoven quartets. That's where the fun viola stuff is. The concerti are, for my taste, even the modern ones, not that – I mean, they're okay. One or two of them are good, but it's really chamber music where the viola shines and where the really interesting viola parts are, I think.
Well, I'm thinking of the late Beethoven quartets in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody gets a break there. Everybody gets a lot of juicy stuff to play.
Right. Or you look at the late Mozart quintets. You know, with two violas. And, I mean, there's some wonderful viola moments. There's the C major, which the second movement is. It's very much like the Sinfonia Concertante. It's a duet between the first violin and first viola. And we could imagine Mozart thinking, you know, playing the viola while he was doing that, although I'm sure he wasn't because he didn't have to do that. But he was definitely thinking as a violist when he wrote that movement.
In a modern symphony now, obviously there are viola parts. There's a viola section in all modern symphonies. Do you find that people have more respect for what the instrument brings to the tone palette of the orchestra?
Yeah, it's coming. The standard of viola playing has gone up a lot, certainly in the 20th century. Actually, this, you know, the Flusscampi was written for one of the very first viola soloists, somebody who made their living on the viola, an English violist named Lionel Tertius. But there were a couple others. Paul Hindemith was actually known as a violist
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. There's a fascinating story about Hindemith, which speaks both to his viola and his composing. He was in England preparing for the premiere. He was going to play the premiere of the Walton Concerto, which is probably the best of the modern concerti. And King George V died. So he locked himself into a room, and overnight he composed a short four-movement piece, funeral music, Trauer music, and they played it the next day on the radio with Hindemith. You know, it was not a solo viola piece, viola and strings. So, you know, not only was he a really, really fine violist, but he was just an incredibly quick composer. And a lot of the core of the 20th century repertoire for viola comes from Hindemith.
Well, going back to the Flusscampi, which is what you're going to be performing on Friday and Saturday night, this is an interesting piece. I mean, it's a beautiful viola part, but you've also got an orchestra. There's an oboe part that kind of goes with you in certain parts. And then there's this chorus that is just not actually singing words, but just sound. And there are parts of it that sound like a film score.
Yep. There's not a piece like it in Vaughan Williams. Not that it doesn't sound like Vaughan Williams, because it does, but he wrote it for Lionel Tertis. One of the reasons it's on this program is that I think of all his music, this one, to me at least, shows most the influence of Ravel. He studied with Ravel. This piece was written in the 20s. He studied with Ravel before the First World War, and they became actually very good friends. Ravel said that Vaughan Williams was the only student he ever had that didn't sound anything like him. And he learned a lot from Ravel about orchestration in particular. But this piece, I think, shows more of that. It's a very delicate orchestration. It's a very small orchestra. And also the wordless chorus, of course, which Ravel used in Daphnis and Chloe. So although it doesn't sound French, it definitely doesn't sound English the way that Vaughan Williams often does. People think Flos Campi, the translation, is flower of the field. And they think, cows and daisies in the pasture. And it's not like that at all. The reference is to the Song of Solomon. And the movements, which are all continuous, each one is prefaced in the score by a quotation from the Bible, the Song of Solomon, although the chorus never sings any of that. So, you have to bear that in mind as you go through the music. And it sounds very, some of it, there's a movement in it that sounds kind of like a very mini Ben-Hur, in fact. And some of it, the end, which is beautiful, beautiful ending, that sounds maybe a little more English. But it really is a unique piece for him. He never wrote anything like it again, and it baffled people back then. I mean, all his friends went and, what is this? And it took a long time, I think, for it to catch on. And it's still, because it's such a strange combination, it's not done often. I've gotten to do it a few times. But it works wonderfully well. It's just, it's a stunningly beautiful piece. It's kind of the analogy I make, it's like Bloch Shlomo, except, written for the viola instead of the cello and written by a English agnostic Anglican instead of, a Swiss Jew. But, you put the two side by side, and there are definitely moments where you can tell.
You can hear that. I mean, now that you mention that, if you know the Shlomo, you hear some of the movement and some of the chordal structures,
right,
and some of the harmonies and also the Ravel influence. I mean, obviously the chorus, but the way he used the oboe.
Mm-hmm.
That's also very Ravel.
That's an interesting moment, too, because he was great friends with Gustav Holst. They did a lot of their exploration of folk music together. And, they would, I think, bounce stuff off each other. Holst, later in his life, became very interested in the concept of polytonality, which is essentially you have two different keys going on at the same time. And this is one of the best instances of that in Vaughan Williams. The opening, in fact, the oboe starts in one key and the viola comes in a completely different one. It doesn't clash, although if you look on a paper, it does. But it's very disorienting at first because you don't, you're wondering kind of what's going on, and yet it's not ugly. It's just disorienting. It's just a little unmoored. The other thing I found interesting about this piece, Vaughan Williams was a big fan of Jan Sibelius. He didn't like Beethoven at all, which was really funny. He loved Bach, but he loved Sibelius. In fact, his Fifth Symphony, on the score it says, dedicated to Jan Sibelius without permission. But one of the things he got from Sibelius, I think, and this piece is a really good example, is the idea that the whole piece grows out of a kernel at the beginning. And a lot of this piece you can really trace back to that opening duo between the oboe and the viola, which goes on for four bars, maybe 15, 20 seconds. And a lot of the melodic material back then, if you look at it carefully, you can trace it back to that interval, the fifth or maybe the augmented fourth that, that gives it its little exoticism and both going on at the same time. And I've not seen that remarked on. I don't think I'm making that up. You know, it's often easy when you do that to you can say, well, everything's kind of a little like something else. But I think that was deliberate with him. I mean, it's a very, you know, the melodic material is it's very tightly constructed.
Can we hear a little
sure,
bit?
Sure, sure.
I know we don't have the chorus and the oboe and the rest of the orchestra, but to get kind of a taste, also just to hear the viola in here is a lovely thing.
So the opening, the oboe part goes. And then the viola comes in a completely different key. And then the oboe goes back, and the viola. So the viola, the oboe is doing it in fifths and fourths. Fourth, in a very normal. And the viola goes. That augmented, instead of. So you get that kind of very exotic quality and a little disorienting because you've got the dissonance between and the viola comes.
You know, I think with the cello, I always think the cello, there's like a longing in a cello mm-hmm. sound. There's like an ache. Mm-hmm. The viola is more melancholy. Mm-hmm. It's there, but as you say, it's not as big. It's not as dramatic. It's not as like hand to brow,
right.
You know. But the emotion is there. it's just maybe more concentrated
right.
and more understated.
Definitely subtle.
Yeah.
You know, violin and violinists are not subtle. they all tell viola jokes, and we try to tell violin jokes back. Fortunately, there are way too many viola jokes that got out of the box.
First. So. Yes.
Oh, it did. Yeah. And we still fight them off.
Well, Robert Levine, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Robert Levine is the principal violist for the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. He'll perform Ralph Vaughan Williams' Flosskampi this Saturday and Sunday at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts. There is more information about the concert at wuwm.com. So, Bonnie, I will not ask you to do any viola jokes coming out of that.
No,
interview.
Although Robert did say there were many, many,
I
many
imagine he
of
has
them.
Heard them all.
I think he has probably more than
how many
once.
Years? 31 years.
31 years here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lifetime of viola jokes.
Yes. But girls, as he points out in the. In the interview, that was the whole reason for becoming a violist.
all right, so
we can't promise girls or 31 years with the MSO, first chair viola, or anything like that, but we can promise you a lifetime of good listening
And a lifetime of being very well informed.
That's
when
right.
When you become a member, in fact, become a sustaining member of WUWM Milwaukee's NPR during this our spring membership drive, help us reach that goal of 12 members by the end of Lake Effect, which is just a few seconds away, and take advantage of this great T-shirt offer at the $10 a month or $120 level by calling
414-227-3210 or by going to wuwm.com/give and making your contribution there. Thank you to everyone who's already done so. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Bonnie, those numbers to call one more time?
414-227-3210. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.